Now, for our past few meetings, we've been going through we've been looking at the book of Proverbs. I was going to say we've been going through Proverbs. That's not exactly right. We're drawing from Proverbs teachings more in a topical way. And that's what we're going to do today is also. We're going to be talking about the Proverbs where Solomon is teaching us what I would call enlightened values. Enlightened values, meaning we all have values, and some people have values that were formed in the dark, or that is when their minds were darkened and were not informed by the Word of God. And so certainly we know that it says in Romans chapter 12 that we need to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And our minds, the mind is not the brain. The mind is your thought processes, your opinions, your attitudes, your values, your beliefs. That's what your mind is. And so when we come to Christ, our minds have already been shaped, especially if we come to Christ as adults. But even, most people don't become extremely serious about the Lord until they're somewhat adult, and they've already picked up a lot from school. So the renewing of our mind is the renewal of these things, our thoughts, our opinions, our attitudes. And a lot of people, when they come to Christ, they don't really intend to change all of that. What they're looking for is a ticket to heaven, and they figure that, you know, if I accept Jesus, I'll go to heaven. Don't ask me to change. Well, we have to change. I mean, our behavior obviously has to change. We have to give up our sinful patterns and live holy life, but that comes from a change that's inside. If you just change your outside without changing what's inside, then, of course, you're just going to be legalist. You're just going to be grudgingly doing what you have to do because you have to do it. But when your mind changes and you begin to value the things of God, then, of course, it becomes quite natural to do the things, at least to seek out to know what the things are that conform to these values, because we all pursue what we value most. And everyone has a hierarchy of values. Everyone has some highest things they value and they esteem, and they'll put those ahead of other priorities in their life. We have a hierarchy of priorities based on our value system. But people do not by nature have the same value system as God does. Remember when Peter was told by Jesus for the first time in Matthew chapter 16 that Jesus was going to die. And this was news to Peter. He didn't like that information. And he said, "Not so, Lord. This will never happen to you." And Jesus spoke to him and said in Matthew 16:23, "Get behind me, Satan. You're an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." In the King James, says, "You do not," I forget the word it uses, but you don't esteem the things of God. You basically, the things that God values, you're not valuing. You're valuing what men value. And that being so, you're wrong in your reaction to what God's plan is. God's plan was for Jesus to die. Well, nobody has that as their value naturally, but that was God's value. And so Peter had to change his, he esteemed the things of man more than the things of God. Jesus, at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, began with a series of sayings called the Beatitudes, where he said, "Blessed," which means enviable and happy, and to be fortunate. Fortunate is are the poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, those who are persecuted, these kinds of things. And those are not the things that most people see as enviable things. Jesus, right from the beginning of his teaching of his disciples there, began with their value system. What do you value? Most people value comfort, popularity, at least a certain amount of financial security, good times. That's what most people value and seek. And what you value is what you will seek. You will seek first the things that you value highest. And so Jesus begins by saying, you're more blessed if you're poor in spirit, if you're mourning for the right reasons. If you're in these categories that the Beatitudes mention, if men persecute you, if men hate you, if they despise you, for righteousness' sake. Now, those are not the things people naturally value. So it's clear that God wants to change our minds, wants to reshape our minds, so that our values are aligned with His. And then, when we truly value what He values, doing what He wants will make sense. It'll make sense. It'll be what we really are inclined to do. When Jesus said, seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness and all these things will be added to you, all these things are the things He said that the Gentiles always seek. The Gentiles are normal, natural people. They seek what natural people seek for. And Jesus said, no, you seek the kingdom. You seek righteousness. Other things that are necessary, God will provide those for you. Those will be added to you, but you don't seek those. Those are not what you value most highly. If you don't value the kingdom of God most highly, then you're not on board with God. You're not thinking like He does. You don't understand His values. We read an interesting statement about Moses in Hebrews chapter 11, and we're going to get over to Proverbs here, which is where we're going. In Hebrews chapter 11, when it's talking about the faith of Moses, it says, verse 24, by faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming, which means valuing, the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. For he looked to the reward. Now think about it. It doesn't say just he esteemed Christ greater riches than the riches of Egypt. The riches of Egypt were the greatest riches in the world at the time. There was nothing the world could offer more to a carnally inclined person than the riches of Egypt. And Moses was in a position to enjoy them to full as an adopted son of the Pharaoh. He had the treasures of Egypt as one of his options. But he esteemed, it doesn't say he esteemed Christ. He said he esteemed the reproach of Christ, which is, of all things about being a follower of Christ, the least attractive. There's many, many blessings in following Christ, and we all know them. But there's also afflictions. And if we think of the whole panoply of what happens to people once they become Christians and live the Christian life, the afflictions are the part you'd kind of like to leave out if you could leave part of it out. But it says it was the afflictions of Christ that he esteemed as greater riches than the riches of Egypt. The afflictions of Christ is the worst thing that following Christ involves for us. The treasures of Egypt is the best thing the world could. It says that Moses put those things in the balance as he esteemed the affliction of Christ as greater riches. That's his value system. That's why he left Egypt, it said, and he did what he did. More valuable than what the world could offer at all. So we see that man's values are contrary to God's values. Jesus said in one place, I think it's in Luke chapter, I think it's Luke 16, but I'm not positive about that. He said, the things which are highly valued by men are an abomination to God. That's a great statement about values that need to change. What is highly esteemed among men, the things men value most, those things are not just not highly valued, they're an abomination to God. So the values of the believer have got to be flipped on their head from what they are naturally. And this is the renewing of our minds. Now, Proverbs, we've been going through themes in Proverbs, and I've printed out some notes for you to make it easy to go through quite a few Proverbs in a short time. That was Luke 16:15 that I quoted. Yeah. Thank you, honey. My wife is my concordance.
Behind every good man.
Yep. Behind every good man is a good concordance. All right.
Was that in your vows?
Yeah. So I had some notes, and this has a variety of statements in Proverbs and a few of them in Ecclesiastes, also written by Solomon, that usually place two things in opposition to each other and says this is better than that. Now, better than means there's a hierarchy of value here. It doesn't say it's the very best thing, although he could have said that. But he's just saying when you compare these two things, it's not that both of them aren't of value. They both have some value, but one has more value than the other. And if you're valuing the thing that he's contrasting it with, then you've got to change your mind. Not because you're under obligation to, but because it just won't work out for you. It won't work out for you if you value the things of man rather than the things of God. I mean, you can survive in the world, but you can't really thrive as a follower of Christ, and you won't enjoy it. Again, I've been told that some of the decisions I made in life, some people will say, well, that's quite a sacrifice you made. I don't feel it. Well, I don't recall making any sacrifices, you know. If you esteem certain things, you'll sacrifice others for them without feeling like you're sacrificing them. I mean, you whenever you buy a loaf of bread, you sacrifice a little bit of money for it. There's a trade-off here. You lose a little money, you get some bread, but you value the bread more than you value that particular amount of money at that moment. Or else you wouldn't make the trade. No one's got a gun to your head. Life is full of trade-offs, exchanges. And we will always, if we have the choice, exchange for something of greater value, something that we value less. We won't feel like we're making a sacrifice. We're just, you know, we're getting a good deal. When Jesus talked about the pearl of great price, he talked about the man who was, he said, the kingdom of God is like the pearl of great price in Matthew 13. The man finds this pearl of great price, and for the joy of owning it, he sells all that he has so that he can buy it. It's not something he feels, oh, man, you know, what a sacrifice I'm making. No, he's getting something. He recognizes what he's getting is worth far more than what he's paying. Even though it's all that he has, he's given up, he's getting something that's worth more than everything he's had. And he does it for the joy of finding it. And that's when you value the things of God as they deserve to be valued. I didn't say as you should, because that almost makes it sound obligatory. I suppose it is obligatory, but that's not how I think of it. I value the things of God not because I'm obligated to. I value them because I figure he knows better than I do what's valuable. Amen. You know, so many times, a little kid, they'll give up something that you as an adult recognize might be worth something in order to have some little trinket that they find valuable. You might advise them against it because you recognize the value, but they don't trust your value system. You know, I've gotten a lot of mailings, you know, junk mail things where they say, oh, Warren Buffett is, you know, buying tons of silver, you know. Well, I'm not a follower of Warren Buffett. What do I care what he buys? Well, the implication is that's a successful man who knows the value of a thing. If he's trading in a lot of his assets for silver, there must be something there. You probably ought to consider doing something like that. And it makes sense. I mean, I don't know the man, but I wouldn't want to follow his value system. But I assume that if he is doing something like that, then probably there's some real value in what he's going for. And no one knows the value of a thing like God does. So Solomon tells us what God's values are. We're studying wisdom literature. And wisdom literature seeks to take a young man, Solomon's son, whom he's giving counsel to in the Proverbs, and impart wisdom to him. And what is wisdom? Wisdom is the ability to recognize what the best goal is among options and what the steps are that are most likely to reach that goal. That's what wisdom is. So the way to reach the best goals is to pursue the best goals. You may fail to reach the best goals only because you didn't identify them and you went for something else. So that's why we want to find out from the Word of God what a wise man would see as the best goals to pursue. And that is partially seen in the things we're going to look at in Proverbs today, which all of them, all the verses in Proverbs we're looking at today always say, this is better than that. And I'm going to put them in some categories. The first category is things that are worth more than money. Now, it's always compared to money in these cases. I mean, some things are not, but all these things at one point or another in Proverbs are compared or contrasted with money. More than great riches, more than rubies, you know. This is to be sought. And the reason for that, of course, is that just about anything other than spiritual things can be acquired if you have money. can't buy you love, as the Beatles told us. But on the other hand, they said, I don't care too much for money. Money can't buy me love. But then they said, give me money. That's what I want. There are some things, valuable things, that can't be purchased with money. But the things of the world can be, basically. And therefore, money is sort of the universal medium of exchange for whatever else you want. You want women, you want pleasure, you want a lot of food, you like fancy toys, even just security, big houses. Money will buy all that if you have enough of it. And so money becomes the value that everything else is contrasted with. But in the place of money, you can also include anything money can buy, which is just about everything except things that really matter most. The first thing that's worth more than money, and of course this one is no surprise because Proverbs is all about this subject, is wisdom, or wisdom and understanding are repeatedly said to be worth more than money. In Proverbs 3:14, it says, her, and in the context, her is the personification of wisdom. Wisdom is personified as a she in Proverbs. Her proceeds are better than profits of silver, and her gain than fine gold. So the gain you have from having wisdom is better than what you gain from silver and gold. Of course, if you have wisdom and you want silver gold, wisdom will help you get it. But if you have a lot of wisdom, you won't value silver and gold as much as if you don't have as much wisdom. Because you'll realize that money has its allure and it promises things. It promises you security. It promises you happiness and fulfillment. And anyone who's ever gotten a lottery realizes, oops, that was a lie. You know, I might be happy and have money. But if I'm happy, it's not because I have money. A lot of people have a lot more money than I do and they're not happy. Money isn't happiness. But wisdom will help you see past the delusion that money will buy you happiness, that money itself is happiness. Sure, you can do some fun things with money. Fun and happiness are not exactly the same thing. And certainly they're not the same thing as joy. But more to be desired than silver and gold are, well, wisdom and understanding. And in Proverbs 8:11 it says, for wisdom is better than rubies, which is the same thing as money in a way, and all things one may desire cannot be compared with her. So whatever else you may want, whatever else could be desired, isn't comparable with wisdom. It doesn't even say wisdom outweighs those things. They're not even worthy to be in the same reckoning. You know, they're like the fine dust in the balances. They don't even affect the balance. They don't even belong in the same world of comparison. Why? Because wisdom, we know Solomon believes the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Therefore, wisdom to Solomon is more than just being smart. Wisdom is being smart about things that knowing God will make you smart about. You see very intelligent, educated people doing very stupid things. You as a Christian can just look on and say, how could they be this stupid? I mean, this more than ever nowadays. I mean, the things in the news, we always have stories about leaders who are, you know, most of them are college educated. A lot of them have law degrees, which may be the problem. But they, you know, they just don't have any common sense at all. Or they might have, what the world calls wisdom, but they throw it away on some temptation here. I mean, billionaires who lose a great deal by a fling with a prostitute or a porn star, you know, that's in the news right now. And, a wise man would say, wait a minute, why do I want to ruin my whole reputation and more, my marriage and all that, for this one temptation? But it's foolish. I mean, anyone looking on who's a Christian would say, that's about as stupid as you can be. You've got so much and you're throwing it all down the toilet for this moment. It's just not wisdom. Wisdom leads to godliness because it begins with the fear of God. And, elsewhere in the scriptures, by the fear of the Lord, men depart from evil. A wise person is going to depart from evil and is going to avoid all kinds of snares of foolishness. And so having wisdom is better than having, you know, gems, rubies, and all things that one may desire can't be compared with it. Now, if you have wisdom, you may get a lot of those other things that one could desire too. A great number of Christians who are godly have a lot of things that people desire. But if they are really wise Christians, they realize that, well, that's icing on the cake. But without that icing, I'd still be a happy man or woman. I'd still have all that matters, you know. Proverbs 15:16 says, how much better to get wisdom than gold, and to get understanding is to be chosen rather than silver. Once again, the same theme. So the first thing among those that we consider in Proverbs that are worth more than money is wisdom. And again, wisdom is not just education. If you can get wisdom through education, then it's worth paying for it. It's worth more than the money you pay. Unfortunately, in our educational system, you pay a lot more money than you get wisdom out of the deal. Most of our education system does not impart wisdom. Knowledge, maybe. If you get a particularly unusually good education, you'll probably get a lot of good, useful knowledge. But wisdom and knowledge are not exactly the same thing. You can know facts, you can be an expert on a subject, but still make very foolish choices and have very, very small grasp on the kinds of issues that run the universe and that make life enriching. So having wisdom is like the starting point. It's the starting point. Now, another thing that's worth more than money, it's a totally different direction he goes here, but there's several proverbs on it. Having a loving and peaceful home. A peaceable domestic life. Now, there's more than one of us in this room who've had, maybe we're married now, but it's not the first time. Or maybe we're not married now, but we've been married in the past. There's different situations here. The marriages that aren't happening anymore were probably not blissful. They might have had their seasons, but frankly, marriages don't usually break up that are blissful. And when they're not blissful, it means there's usually strife. There's usually some conflict. There's things about it that kind of make you wish you didn't get into that situation. And having, you know, if you're in an unhappy marriage or an unhappy home where there's strife, where there's bickering, where there's not like-mindedness, you realize how much you would trade out of that situation. You get rid of a lot of the money you have if it gets you into a more peaceful, loving domestic situation. And Solomon knew that. He probably had a lot of strife in his marriages because he had so many wives. The Bible doesn't ever depict a polygamous marriage that's happy. There are a number of polygamous marriages, but you never have a record of one where the wives got along with each other or very well with their husbands, either. And Solomon had that on steroids, you know, because he had a lot more women. And so he must have known what an unpeaceful house was like. He had money. He feasted. He ate stalled oxen. But he didn't have love. He didn't have peace in his home. And he knew. He said in Proverbs 15:17, better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted calf with hatred. A simple meal with people who love each other is much more fulfilling than people who hate each other sitting over a huge feast, steak dinner. Now, this is not advocating vegetarianism, by the way. It's simply saying vegetarianism or herbs would be a simple meal. And he's just saying, even if you've got sparse provisions, that you got love in the home, you're richer than the man who's got a pantry full of food, a freezer full of meat, big spread on his table every day, and doesn't have anyone who loves him at the table. This makes domestic tranquility a very high value, much higher than even many married Christians value it. There are, as I said, a great number of Christians, I don't want to say the majority, but a pretty good percentage of us in this room have had at least one marriage fail. And when I hear of Christians, especially Christians married to Christians, and they're thinking, maybe we're going to split up. I think, why don't they just love each other? I say, well, it's easier said than done. I know it's easier said than done. But it's when you break up your marriage, that's harder still. You know, having a former spouse hostile to you is almost as bad as having a spouse hostile to you. How about we remove the hostility? You know, it's not the spouse that's the common denominator, it's the hostility. Anyone can say, okay, I forgive you. Let's work on this. This marriage, it's more valuable to us to have this marriage be peaceful than for us to get our way. And of course, you know, people who divorce, often they've got strife over everyday issues. Strife over the children, strife over sex, strife over money. But money is a big one. But Solomon said, hey, a good marriage is better than money. Better to have a cheap meal because you can't afford more, but have a loving household than expensive provisions because you got money, but you don't have love in the home. And whenever I hear Christians that are thinking about separating or giving up on the marriage, I think, what are you thinking? You know, why would you want to do that? You need to aim at domestic tranquility. This is especially true. It's always true. It's especially true if there's children. Nothing is worse for children than for their parents to be at odds with each other. Well, the one thing that's worse is for their parents to split up. We all know, if you've read the statistics, and many of you have children who've been through a divorce too, that the children of divorce are statistically an extremely high risk categories for suicide, for antisocial behavior, for drug abuse, for criminality, for teen pregnancy, for later divorce in their own lives. I mean, it's staggeringly high risk categories for kids from divorce homes. I mean, you're destroying your kids, or at least if you don't, it's only by a miracle and the grace of God that you didn't. Because basically, your kid, you're doing the best thing you can do to doom your kids, basically, to a bad life if you break up. Let's face it, having a home where love is wonderful. Now, I've had a marriage that wasn't happy and that failed. I didn't leave it, and I would never leave it. But part of the reason was my family I grew up in was peaceful. My parents never argued, as far as I know. I mean, us kids never saw them argue. I remember, you know, when my parents were in their 90s, I remember asking them, have you guys ever argued? And my mom said, not really. You know, and it's like, I just can't even imagine them being hostile toward each other. And us kids, there were never any fighting among us kids. We didn't have a quiet home. You know, we were all pretty strong personalities and so forth, but it was a peaceful home. And once you've had that, you realize that I'll sacrifice anything for that. Except God. I won't sacrifice God for that. Any money, you bet. I'd much rather be in poverty in a loving domestic situation than be rich. And that's what Solomon found out the hard way, too. In Proverbs 17:1, he says, better is a dry morsel with quietness than a house full of feasting with strife. So it's the same concept. In Ecclesiastes 4:6, says, better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. So again, quietness rather than toil and stress and striving. Better to have only one handful and quiet rather than two hands full and bickering and strife. These next two are fairly famous sayings of Proverbs. Proverbs 21:9. The same proverb, word for word, is also found in Proverbs 25:24. Better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. And it's later in the same chapter, he says, Proverbs 21:19, better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. And some of you have heard this joke several times. I never heard it until one of my students came up with it. In fact, he made it up, I think. We were going through Proverbs and devotions at our school years ago in Oregon. and going through these Proverbs. And going through Proverbs 19, one of my students said, I can just picture how this chapter was written. He said, Solomon is sitting at his desk trying to write the Proverbs, and his wife is there, you know, yapping at him and so forth. So he picked up his writing materials, went upstairs to the housetop, and he wrote, it's better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a contentious woman. And then she came up there and she was yapping at him, so he picked all up, he went out in the wilderness and said, better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious. He had to modify that from experience, you know.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting. It's interesting that saying that makes some people, Terry, you feel that way too, feel like, uh-oh, going to make the women mad. Only if you got contentious women.
Right?
Solomon's not saying anything about women per se. He's talking about a certain kind of woman. He's got a lot of things to say about certain kinds of men too. In fact, almost all the Proverbs are about certain kinds of men he doesn't respect. But he's talking to his son about his son's likely to pick a wife, saying, you don't want a contentious woman for a wife. You'd rather live in a little corner of your housetop and just leave the rest of the house to your wife than share that house with her because she's contentious. Now, obviously a man can be contentious too, and that's not good either. Being contentious is a bad thing, and that's what causes strife in the home. But that's what he's saying. Solomon, of course, how contentious he may have been with his wives, I don't know. He knew it from the man's side. He had the experience of women who apparently, some of his wives apparently were like to fight with him, and I can see why. He wasn't exactly probably an easy man to be married to. But the point here is, everyone would like to be in a nice home, I suppose, but better to have, if you have to live in a treehouse in the wilderness, if that's what it takes to have peace. Having peace in your home is what's hard. So a loving and peaceful home is worth more than money. And again, any couple that has strife over money should consider this, you know? I mean, because it's not the only thing couples strive over, but they do strive about money in many cases. You say, hey, the money is not worth it. Our peace, our unity, our love for each other, that's got to be the thing we value most here, and not how well or how badly we're doing financially. Okay, the third category of things that's worth more than money is good character. Now, there's several things under this subheading, all of them in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, mostly Proverbs. Good character. Now, we talked about wisdom. Wisdom will no doubt lead to good character, because if you're wise, you'll know what good character is, and you'll know how valuable it is, and you'll pursue it. But good character itself is made up of a number of traits that have to be cultivated directly and deliberately. The first of those traits is the fear of the Lord. In Proverbs 15:16, better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. Again, it's the same kind of thing. This is worth more than money. Better to have the fear of the Lord, even if you have a little bit of money, than to have a great treasure and have, you know, the troubles that come, obviously means that come from not having the fear of the Lord. The troubles you get yourself into when you're stupid enough not to fear God. Now, fearing God is intelligence. It's the beginning of wisdom. If you don't fear God, you don't have the beginning of wisdom. You haven't started to be smart yet. I mean, there's a lot of things a person with a modicum of wisdom might not know. But anyone who's got an atom or a molecule of wisdom knows there's a God. And if there's a God, nothing matters more than that. And this is something I find so amazing about people who take God lightly. Listen, if there's no God, he doesn't matter at all. Stay away from all religion, stay away from all considerations of morality even, unless, I mean, an atheist can care about morality because he doesn't want to mess up his relationships and so forth. And of course, there's a certain morality atheists know, but it'd be for selfish reasons primarily. But if there's no God, just don't play games with religion. He doesn't matter because he doesn't exist. But if there is a God, then nothing else could conceivably matter before you've got that squared away. unless you've got God on your side, you better hope there's no God. Because having God not on your side is got to be the worst of all possible scenarios. And the fear of God is the fear of having God not on your side. You know, realizing that you're living in a way that God is obliged to oppose. Because the Bible says God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. God resisting you, you really want that? The creative universe, you want Him resisting you? How absurd. And yet, certain ways we live, or could live, certainly invite His resistance. And fear of the Lord is just being smart enough to say, I'm not going to make God my enemy. I may not be able to get through this life without making any enemies, but I'm going to make sure God's not one of them. Doesn't matter how many other enemies I have, I'd rather have none, but since I'll probably have some, I'm going to make sure that the one person who's not my enemy is God. Because that's scary. It doesn't mean I live in terror. It just means I'm smart enough to stay on the good side of God. So I don't have to live in terror. But it's because of the appreciable danger of having God against you that an intelligent person will make the first priority. Whatever I do, whatever else I pursue in life, I'm going to make sure that I'm pursuing something that is not opposed to God, and ideally something that God especially has in mind for me. Because His will, I figure God's smart enough to know what's best for me. If I do anything other than His will, I'm choosing something that's at least second or third or fourth or tenth best. The only way to have what's best for me is to pursue God's will for me. And I should be, as it were, afraid to do otherwise. Not because of the concept, you know, I'm going to go to hell if I don't do everything right. But because we live in a world where we're conscious of there being a God. And I think that many religious people, Christian and otherwise, they kind of have God as part of the mental furniture of their worldview. Yeah, sure. I mean, yes, do you believe God? Yeah, I guess so. Sure. I guess there's a God. How can anyone live a life with that? I guess there's a God. If there's a possibility that there's a God, can anything be more urgent than to discover that He is or is not there? And if He is, or even if you haven't really discovered, you think He probably is, or very well could exist. What can be more urgent than say, how do I align myself with His wishes? Anyone who doesn't have that going on is not a smart person at all. But they also won't be a very good person. True, atheists, they say, we don't need God to be moral. They say, we can be good without God. They actually have a slogan in Great Britain. They had it on the buses. We can be good without God. And I think, well, it depends on what you're calling good. You mean you don't murder people? Well, that's good. Although a lot of people without God do murder people. Good on you if you're not one of those. You know, you can be faithful to your wife without knowing God? Yeah, you probably can. Lots of non-Christians are probably faithful to their wives outwardly anyway. Although, why? Probably because they know they'd have hell to pay, not from God, but from their wife, if they weren't faithful. Or, you know, they realize complications. Some people are smart enough to know that certain kinds of immoral behavior put you into a complicated situation that some people would rather just not be in, even if there's no God. But you see, that's not the same thing as saying, I know there's a God, and I will do all things to please Him because that's what I'm made to do. And I will love those that He loves, and I will lay down my life for them, and I'll help the poor, and I'll visit the sick, and I'll do those things, not because I'm trying to get brownie points, but because I care about the things God cares about. That's being good. That's good conduct. Atheists will never do things like that for that reason. They might do philanthropic things because they get a good tax break or because they get a monument named after them or a school named after them or a street named after them or whatever. But to do things thinking, I may get nothing out of this, but there's a God, and for Him to be pleased is the only thing that makes sense in His universe. And I'm part of His universe, so what else? And that's the fear of God. And that leads to genuinely righteous behavior. And that's the next thing on the list. Righteousness and justice. It says in Proverbs 16:8, better is a little with righteousness than vast revenues without justice. Now, righteousness and justice are coupled together in the Bible a lot. They're almost the same thing. We probably think of them as different. We might think of righteousness as, I don't know, just we might think of it as righteous religious behavior. But justice, we recognize, is something that has to do with even the way the government should run. And I mean, there should be justice. That's why we have a criminal justice system. There should also be justice in our actions toward other people. But again, the real basis for any kind of righteous behavior or justice in life, any commitment to it, is the fear of God. Now, again, anyone who doesn't know God could somehow find, they could become enamored with the concept of justice. But the truth is that without putting God first, you're always in some place within you, you're putting yourself first. It's the only two options, really. Those are the two rivals, God and you, always. And if you're putting yourself first, even if you love the concept of justice, there might be some utopian concept of justice that you know, in the fantasy realm that you're thinking of, or you might be just thinking you want to be treated justly. But the idea that you should treat all others justly, just because that's the principle that animates God himself. He's a God of justice. Well, you're not using God as your frame of reference, and so you're not going to be consistent. You'll be just as long as you think you can get away with it or not suffer too much from your bad behavior. But good character is when you do righteousness and you do justice, because that's really what, that's coming from where you are. That's who you are. You care about God, his nature, his values, and you adopt those as your own. Another thing that's worth more than money, according to Proverbs, is integrity. And I use the word integrity to mean honesty, you know, basically strong obsession with what's true. A person who has integrity obviously doesn't lie to you. They don't make promises that they don't keep. You know, they live by their principles. That's integrity. It says in Proverbs 19:1, better is the poor who walks in his integrity than one who is perverse in his lips and is a fool. Now, it's interesting how that ends, because you'd expect the contrast to be different. And it is in Proverbs 28:6, which begins the same way but ends differently. Proverbs 28:6 says, better is the poor who walks in his integrity than one perverse in his ways, though he is rich. You see, those two proverbs are about the same, except the first one ends, he's perverse in his ways and is a fool. But you'd think that it was, the contrast was going to be between being poor, because the poor man and the fool are contrasted. Whereas in the other one, 28:6, it says the poor man and the rich are contrasted, which is more natural. However, I think what he's saying is, in the second one, what is contrasted is the poverty of one man and the riches of the other. In the first one, what's being contrasted is the integrity of the one man, not his poverty. He's poor, but he has his integrity. The other man is rich, or it doesn't say he's rich, he just says he's perverse, and he's a fool. He doesn't have his integrity, and that's foolish. So anyway, the point is integrity of character. It matters more than anything. I don't want to give examples too much. I've given too many times, but that's just something that when I was young, somehow God just convicted me of the need to be faithful, because God is faithful, and people will not know that God is faithful if they don't see uncompromising faithfulness in his people. I remember as a teenager having this strongly a strong conviction that if I make a promise, I better keep it. I don't care how inconvenient it is to keep it. It says in Psalm 15, the man who swears to his own hurt and doesn't change is the man who will dwell in God's holy place. Well, I want to dwell in God's holy place. So swearing to your own hurt means you promise something, you swear you'll do it. Uh-oh, it's going to cost more than I thought. It's going to hurt me to do this. I swore to my hurt. It hurts me to have sworn to do this. But I don't change. He that swears to his own hurt and does not change is a person whose integrity matters more than avoiding the hurt that comes from keeping his promises. It's more important that I walk away from every transaction with my conscience clear and my integrity intact than that I came out ahead on the transaction. And I won't go into this in detail, but I'll give this example because I don't think I gave it in my books when I was talking about this subject. I gave several others. When I lived in Santa Cruz, I ran discipleship schools in the summertime, 3 different years. But they're only summertime, so I didn't maintain property so I could house these students year-round. They were only there for 3 months out of the year, so I had to get different, had to find someplace to house 25 or so people each summer and not maintain it during the other 9 months because I couldn't afford to pay for it. So the third year I did this, we were looking around for a property to do the school. And a friend of mine at church said he was going away to Hawaii. He owned a house in Santa Cruz. It was kind of a big house. And he said, he's trying to rent it out while he's in Hawaii. It would coincide with when I needed a place. So I went to look at it, and it was a big house. It wasn't ideal, but I was getting a little close to summertime. I didn't want to have the students show up. I don't have anywhere for them to be. So I told him, I'll rent it from you. Well, like the next week, I ran across a much better property, which was even a better deal. It was like 2 buildings with a courtyard in between, and it just had the kind of setup that would be good for housing 25 students for 3 months. And I knew I had to get that. So I went back to him, my friend, and said, Larry, I hate to do this, but I found a better place than your house for what I need. And I wonder if you'd let me out of that deal. And he was indignant. He says, brother, you promised that you'd take it. I've had people, want to rent it from me. And I told him it's already taken. And he said, I would expect you to keep your promise. I said, well, I will. I was just seeing if you'd let me out of it. But I'll rent your place even if I don't use it. I've got to rent this other one. I don't know how I'll afford it. But I never knew how I'd afford anything anyway. I've never known how I'm going to afford anything. It's just you go into it knowing God's going to provide. So I was really concerned about that. But I said to Larry, I'll rent it from you. But if someone else comes along who wants to tell them it's available. So I was going to keep that promise, and I rented this other place that we were actually going to use, and his place was across town. We weren't even going to set foot there. I was just going to pay the rent on it somehow. Anyway, thank God someone came along who wanted his place, and I didn't have to rent both places because that would have been really crazy. But I just thought, well, there's no way I'm going to just say, I know I promised, but I can't do it, so that's tough for you, We don't have a signed contract. I can get out of it. But to me, having a signed contract shouldn't matter at all. Mm-hmm. If you gave someone reason to believe that you would do something, then do it. Even if it's not good for you, even if you've sworn to your own hurt, don't change. Why? Because your integrity is far more important than your convenience, more than your money. Better is a poor man who walks in his integrity than a fool who's perverse and is rich. So, maintaining your integrity. This is so important for married couples, too, because marriage is hard at times. Mine hasn't been, but I've been in a hard marriage before. I certainly know what it's like. And I would tell you, of course, it was hard. It just isn't. I mean, we've had a very easy marriage, thankfully.
I would tell you.
Yeah. Harder for her, perhaps. Yeah. It's been easy for me. But, when people are in hard marriages, if not people of integrity, if integrity isn't the top priority, then getting out of that marriage is often in the back of their mind, maybe at the front of their mind. A person of integrity won't even let the word divorce come to their mind, ever. You make a promise, you swear in the name of God that you're going to stay together for life. You don't even think about it. Now, your partner might, but you don't. And it's better to be unhappily married and working on it, working on making it happier, than to shatter your integrity and say, I made a solemn promise before God and man, and I'm just walking out on it. That's abandoning your integrity, and you might as well abandon everything you own as do that. Sooner abandon everything you own than abandon your integrity. Once you've lost your integrity, you don't have anything of value. You're basically, if you break up your marriage and you don't, and you did it, you've broken your vows, you might as well just wear a t-shirt that says,
liar.
Don't trust me to ever keep a promise to you. You know, I'm not an honest person. I mean, if I can make a solemn vow in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit at a wedding, and to the most, you know, the person I love the most at the time, and later just say, I don't think so, then who will you keep a promise to? If not to God, and if not to your parents and your friends and the witnesses and your wife or husband. You know, if you won't keep promise to them, I can't expect you to keep promise to me about anything. Another thing, and this is related to integrity, another thing that's worth more than money and part of good character is a good name. This is in Ecclesiastes. Oh, it's in Proverbs too. I didn't put it in the notes because I remembered this proverb after I'd already printed the notes, which is too bad. But Proverbs 22:1 says, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, loving favor more than silver and gold. So again, a good name. What's that? That's a good reputation. If your reputation is spoiled, first of all, I'll probably ruin you for business, because your clients won't trust you and they'll go somewhere else. But also it just ruins you with God. It ruins your testimony. If you have a bad name in the community and you're testifying for Christ, what's that doing to his testimony? What's that doing to his reputation? You know, when Paul talks about the elders, you know, what the qualifications are for elders, he says one who's blameless, you know, one who's got a good report. These are the important things that your reputation is unsullied. And by the way, having integrity is what determines that. Now, of course, you can have your reputation smeared even if you've done nothing wrong by someone bearing false witness against you, which is the reason there's a command to get one of the Ten Commandments is against them. Do not bear false witness against somebody, because their reputation is of more value than money. And you destroy their good name when they didn't do anything to deserve that. It's like stealing money from them, only something worth more than money. Bearing false witness, slandering, libel, gossip. To destroy someone's good name is a great, great crime before God. But doing all you can, of course, maintain your integrity is the best way to keep your good name. It says in Ecclesiastes 7:1, a good name is better than precious ointment. And in Ecclesiastes 10:1, it said, dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor. So does a little folly in one respected for wisdom and honor. Now, what he's saying there is a perfumer, no doubt, has a big vat of perfume he's making. It smells good. A few dead flies, little tiny intrusions into it. I've never been there to see this happen, but Solomon obviously knew what he was talking about. A few dead flies in the perfumer's ointment makes it stink. He says that's how it is if you got a good reputation and you do a little folly, a little foolishness. You ruin your good name. You make your good name foul in the nose of society. Just a couple more things here. One is humility and sobriety are worth more than money. I put these two together because the things that are said here about it are kind of overlapping. Better to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. Now, dividing the spoil means you got money. Again, it's typical comparing one thing with money. And everything he compares is worth more than money, including humility. Better to be of a humble spirit with the lowly. To be with the lowly. Now, most people who are social climbers don't want to be with the lowly. They want to be with people who are prestigious. Proverbs 16:19 is that one. Better to, as it says in the New Testament, associate with men of low estate. Don't choose famous people to be with, even though that can help you financially. If you're well connected with the famous people, usually have money. That's why they're famous. Or maybe they're famous for other reasons and that fame generates money. For example, movie stars are famous not because they have money, but they have money because they're famous. But other people are famous because they have money. And for very little other reason. They don't have much else going for them, but they got a lot of money, and that makes them, everyone knows their name. So one who wants money will generally want to climb socially as high as they can in the social hierarchy and hang out with the people who have the most connections, the most money, the ones who can recommend them to, you know, the contractors or to others that will they'll make money off of. He says, now, you better be with the lowly people. The lowly people are not usually the rich people, and they're often humbler than the rich people. And that's a much safer place to be. Better there than to divide the spoil with the proud. Now, Ecclesiastes 7, 2 through 5 on this same point. Better to go to the house of mourning, and this is not the exactly the same idea, but I see a connection. Better to go to the house of mourning, which means to a funeral, than to the house of feasting, which means to a party. You got a choice? You're better off going to a funeral than to a party. Why? Why would that be so? He says, because that is the end of all men. What is? Funerals. Not everyone's going to end up at a party, but everyone's going to end up at a funeral. You're all going to die. And the living will take heart. If you go to a funeral, you always think about, wow, he was just here a week ago. He was so healthy, he seemed, or so alive. And a year ago, I remembered we never suspected he'd be gone by now. Well, maybe I'll be the next one. Maybe it'll be my friend saying that about me next. Who knows? When you go to a funeral, it reminds you of your mortality. It's a very healthy thing. It's not a morbid thing. It's a healthy thing. If you forget that you're going to die, even for a moment, then you're likely to take life for granted. Take your health for granted. That's not a safe thing to do. It's good to keep always in mind that you're going to die. I read when I was younger a book called A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life by William Law. And he had this story in there about a man, a tradesman on his deathbed whose friends came to visit him as the doctors had given him up. And he records this little speech this guy gave to his friends. And he says, you know, I realize you think it's a very tragic thing that I'm dying in my youth, you know, in the middle of my prosperity. He says, and I might have thought the same thing about you if you were in my condition, I was in yours. But he says, a man in my condition now doesn't have any thoughts like that at all. He says, do you think it would be any comfort to me if I were on the verge of death to know that I'd lived 80 years instead of 30? Do you think it would concern me if I died with, you know, a bank vault full of gold rather than, you know, in the business of my shop, which is not so wealthy? But he says, those thoughts are so far from me, I couldn't even imagine the littleness of those things now. And he goes into his eloquent speech about how all the things in his life had distracted him from the things that mattered for eternity. He says, how is it that a little bit of health, a little bit of poor trade in a shop can hold off these thoughts, these heavy thoughts of eternity? You know, he says, it's just a very powerful passage. The man's an excellent writer. But the point is that when I read that as a teenager, I thought, yeah, I mean, that's how a man would feel on his deathbed toward the things of the world. And that's how, since we all might die any moment, that's how we should all feel toward the things of the world. You know, yeah, I mean, improve your circumstances as you have opportunity, but always know this thing is no more important right now than it will be when I'm on my deathbed. You know, on my deathbed, that's when I will see things clearly. That's when I will see the true value of all the things that were so distracting to me now. And because I'm facing eternity. And that's what Solomon means, I think, when he says it's better to go to the house of mourning, that is the funeral, than to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter in that context he's talking about. For it is a sad countenance, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. It's like Jesus said, blessed are you who mourn. It's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. Now, it's that line that connected it with the previous proverb in my mind. Better to hear the rebuke of the wise. In a sense, when you go to a funeral, it rebukes your attitude of taking everything for granted, you know. It's a wise rebuke. Better than going to the party and just hearing the songs of the fools you know, better to hear the rebuke of the wise. But also hearing the rebuke of the wise is a humbling, it's a humble thing. If you listen to a rebuke, it's a measure of your humility that you do so. And there's a lot in Proverbs about that we won't go into. But the, you know, wise man likes correction, likes to be rebuked, likes to be set right. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing to have something bring you up short, whether it's somebody wisely rebuking you or suddenly someone you thought was going to live longer is dead. It rebukes your whole presumption of life. And it's good to, it's better to have those somber thoughts than to just be partying and forgetting everything that's reality. And people do party to forget in many cases, I assume. I've never deliberately gotten drunk in my life. I've had a little too much at one time or two, but it never really, it never went very far. But when people get drunk, I think mostly they're probably trying to forget something that's either something about life that they'd rather not be thinking about at the moment. I can't speak for them, but that's what I assume. I think, well, forgetting those things is not wise. It may be comfortable to forget things, but the things that are uncomfortable are things that we have to deal with in many cases, and avoiding that by partying is certainly a stupid thing to do. Better to be humble with the lowly, better to be mourning with the bereaved than to be dividing the spoil of the proud and rejoicing with the party animals. You know, that's what Solomon is saying. Now, the last thing here is what's worth more than money is, this one isn't said to be worth more than money. It's just one thing is better than another thing. This is the one thing that he doesn't compare with money, and that's fine. It's very instructive. In Proverbs 16:32, he who is slow to anger, which is parallel with ruling your spirit, he who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. He who rules his spirit is better than he who takes a city. Now, a man who takes a city, like Alexander the Great or some great conqueror, Pompey or somebody, you know, he'll get a lot of accolades. He's a man's man. He's powerful in the world's eyes and becomes more powerful with every city he conquers. And yet many people like that have never learned to rule their spirit. Being slow to anger, Proverbs describes as being ruling your spirit. The assumption being that you don't want to be angry if you're smart. You don't want to fly off the handle. You don't want to lose your composure. You don't want to lose your objectivity. If you're smart, you'll refrain from anger as best you can. Now, you can get angry, but you'll be slow to anger. God himself is said to be slow to anger and plenteous in mercy. God can get angry. We should be patient. We should be long-suffering. But there are things that we should be angry with. There's righteous anger about things. But we should not be someone who's got a hair trigger or a short fuse. It should be very hard to get us angry. I remember I was watching a podcast yesterday, and the podcaster was talking about how there was a headline in the news yesterday that says something like, conservatives are outraged over the transgender shooting at the school. And he was saying, what, are conservatives the only ones outraged about that? Shouldn't everybody be outraged about that? They make it sound like somehow there's something, you know, wrong with us because we're outraged at six people being shot at a school and three of them children. He said, but these same people who think we shouldn't be outraged by that, they're outraged if you misgender them. They go into a crisis. They fly off the handle. They can't handle you calling them by a pronoun they don't want you to use. And yet, they blame us for getting angry at somebody who kills children. You know, I mean, the world is just so confused. We should be angry at certain things. There are certain things, if we're not angry about them, we won't do anything about them. And God's angry about them. We shouldn't be angry people who, when someone offends us, we can't handle it. We should have very thick skin. We should not be easily offended. And we should, of course, not go out of our way to offend other people either. But you know, if we're easily offended, that's on us. We're just immature, thin-skinned. We're not slow to anger. We don't have rule over our own spirit. If somebody can make you angry, you're not ruling your spirit. They are. It was Will Rogers, I think, maybe. Is he the cowboy comedian kind of philosopher? Yeah. I remember he said, I am at the mercy of any man who can make me lose my temper. And think about it. If someone can make you lose your temper, they're controlling you. They're ruling your spirit. You rule your spirit. You should be a kind of person that they can do all they can to provoke you. It says in 1 Corinthians 13, love is not provoked. Why? Because I'm not going to let you determine the state of my spirit. I'm not going to let you decide if I'm angry or not. That's my choice, and I'm going to rule my spirit. And I'll be slow to, I'll get angry when it's right. What's the right time to be angry, but not when you want me to. And so a person who is slow to anger and who rules the spirit is better than a mighty person. And many people would love to be in the position of a mighty person. Better to be a person who controls the spirit. You know, Alexander the Great conquered the whole world of his time, the whole Persian Empire, by the time he was 33 years old. And then, but he died either of syphilis or drinking himself to death. There's conflicting stories. I think he had syphilis and he drank himself to death. But neither of those are examples of ruling your spirit well. You're not ruling your life very well. You can conquer nations, but you can't conquer your own desires and your own lusts. A man who rules his spirit is a better man than a mighty conqueror. And there's some other Proverbs, but that's Proverbs 19:11 says, the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger. Discretion means wisdom. If a man's smart, he'll be slow to anger. And his glory is to overlook a transgression. In other words, if someone transgresses against you, someone does some offense to you, it's your glory to overlook it. It's like you're the adult if you can absorb an insult and not get, you know, set off by it. It's your glory to overlook it. A couple other similar proverbs are in Proverbs 25:28. It says, whoever has no rule over his own spirit, and we know from the other proverbs that means whoever is quick to anger. The man who's slow to anger is said to be the one who has a rule over his spirit. He who has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls. What's that saying? A city broken down without walls is it's defenseless. You know, in those days, walls kept the invaders out, at least as long, longer than if you didn't have walls. But if your walls are broken down, there's not much to keep the invaders out. You'll be ruled by somebody else. If you don't rule yourself, if you don't rule your own spirit, someone else will rule your spirit for you. Someone else will control you. Keep the walls up that keep other people from gaining control over your spirit. Self-control, but especially control of your mood. But I mean any self-control. Control your appetites. You know, controlling your lusts, certainly. As much as Paul, controlling your thoughts. All that self-control is what will prevent other people from controlling you. Now, they may control you by force. That is, they may make you stop talking by holding you down, stuffing gauze in your mouth, you know. But you can't help that. But if you can control your own speech, then you're a wise and a better person. One other scripture about this idea of self-control or of mainly of controlling your spirit is in chapter 29. This will be the last verse today. 29:11, a fool vents all his feelings. I think the King James says speaks his whole mind. But a fool vents all his feelings, but a wise man holds them back. In other words, you don't have to say everything that comes to your mind. You don't have to react to every insult. You don't have to fight back. You don't have to retaliate. You don't have to get in a verbal brawl. The wise man holds it back. He doesn't just have something come around, oh, I'm going to say this. Yeah, that's the fool. The fool just speaks whatever comes to his mind, invents his feelings. He doesn't rule his spirit. He doesn't control his tongue. But the wise man does. He holds it in until afterwards. Now, holds it until afterwards, I think, would suggest holds it until he's had time to think about whether that's something he should say or not. Doesn't mean you'll never say something in response to, you know, a provocation, but you hold it in until you know what you should say. And the wise man considers before he speaks, sets his mind in gear before he puts his mouth in motion, in other words. So those are some values. I mean, frankly, almost everybody values money. Those people who have a lot of money usually value it. People who don't have enough money often value it. Sometimes can be obsessed with it. But keeping money as one of the lower end values when you're seeking things that are worth more than treasures, more than rubies, more than gold, more than silver, wisdom, the fear of God, domestic tranquility, good character, your integrity, humility, a good name, and ruling your own spirit. Those are the things that Solomon, by saying this is better than that, he's saying, in other words, when you have a choice to make between these two, take the better one. In your hierarchy of values, both things can be in your values. You can say, I'd like to have a more comfortable life someday, but that's going to be so far down. That's one of the first things you'll sacrifice for the things higher in the list of priorities in the hierarchy. And that's something we're not conditioned to do. We're conditioned to make enough money to be comfortable and to measure our success by how comfortable we are compared to other people who we could be as comfortable as if we made it our priority. But Christians have different priorities, different hierarchy of values. And so that's what that species of proverb is trying to get at. There's a lot of those in that category. And so we've looked at, I think, most of them. There might be a few we missed, but they're pretty much on the same lines.